So the deal is, as noted, we're mourning the demise and celebrating the existence of Comics Buyer's Guide. Absolutely. And so I asked various people to attend, and the reason RC didn't till now have his little label was that he didn't receive my message. And I see other people who also contributed to CBG lurking about in the audience, as, for example, Mr. Ward Batty, who's midway back and a retailer and all that fine stuff. And presumably during the questions and answers, they'll pop up and say things that I've forgotten to say. So I'm Maggie Thompson. I'll tell you about the beginnings of Buyer's Guide in a minute. But in the meantime, let me introduce the other panel members who all contributed to the wonder that was Comics Buyer's Guide. And this is Mark Evanier. Yay!
That's what we call a smattering.
Yes. You could say who you are.
Oh.
I'm sure thousands of people here do not know who you are.
I was the very first columnist ever in the Comics Buyer's Guide before Maggie had it.
Footnote, yes, endorsement, yes.
That's right. Yes. That's right. I did one column and then never, didn't do another one for like 12 years or something.
Right. But by your own decision, not because you were not requested, begged.
Alan White didn't really care. So
all right. Next on the panel is R.C. Harvey. A special guest this year, I point out.
What?
You are a special guest this year, I point out.
Oh, yeah, right. I'm going to start thinking of this panel as the number 1700 of the Buyer's Guide.
There you go.
Which I thought, that's one of the great tragedies of the Buyer's Guide, is that the publisher drew the curtain and throw everybody under the bus with number 1699.
Yes.
What a lot of horseshit.
I will tell you why that was a good thing.
Oh.
So, isn't that great? So I'm going to tell you some preliminary stuff, and then I'll do that was a good thing. And this is Scott Brick, who did probably our most popular single article that we ever ran. He is an award-winning... Oh, tell him who you are.
If you look at my bio in the program guide, you'll probably be like, what the hell is an audiobook narrator doing on this panel? But before I was doing audiobooks, I was writing about comic books. And yeah, I had the great good fortune of meeting Maggie, being introduced to Maggie by Randy Rinaldo there in the back. And I got to write for the magazine for a number of years.
Yes, but your most popular piece was your journalistic expose.
Yes, the one time I get to play... crusading journalist, and I decided I would track that. At Comic-Con years ago, I heard John Romita talk about how he didn't know where the snap in Gwen Stacy's neck came from, because it wasn't...
Spoiler, by the way, I'm sorry for those who don't know.
Sorry.
Gwen Stacy.
Here there be spoilers. And I just thought, you know, it was the anniversary of Gwen's passing, and I said, let's get to the bottom of this. So... I wrote this article, and really the magazine, everybody at the magazine, John Jackson Miller, created this great design on the front cover, Who Killed Gwen Stacy? And still the article I'm most proud of.
And can we do the spoiler? We know
sure.
Who the spoiler was.
The spoiler was, it was the writer. and now, why am I blanking on his name?
No, it wasn't.
Jerry Conway, yes, thank you.
Jerry Conway. Lynn wouldn't have done
he
that.
He told me that he says... I never liked Gwen. He says, I was a Mary Jane partisan, so I wanted to get rid of her.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, well, you could have made her more interesting.
Yeah, you're the writer.
The but okay, whatever. At least he copped to it.
Yes, this is true. Very okay.
Me too, thank you.
Yeah, me too, exactly. So now the background is somebody writing about this, and maybe it was Comic-Con, said that Don and I founded Comics Buyer's Guide. And someone immediately jumped in to say...
Yes, I wrote that. You founded it. Yes.
Yes, yes. And in a way we did, which we didn't know until Comic-Con in 1976, when Comic-Con flew us out to be special fan guests, and Alan Light, who also came out, was on a panel telling about how he began Buyer's Guide, for which we were then doing Beautiful Balloons, our column therein. And he said, well, what had happened was... Don and Maggie Thompson were doing a newsletter called Newfangles, and it was sort of fan news. It eventually carried pro news as well, but in science fiction fandom, there was a, you know, who's moving, you know, what should you watch out for, so-and-so is sick, send him a get well card, that kind of thing, a newsletter every month. And it got to be a nightmare. At 1 o'clock in the morning at one point, we were doing the fold, staple, label, stamp, go on to the next one for the issues we were mailing out. And it was a roll of stamps that Don had, and he was doing it. This was back when you licked the stamps. So he's licking the stamps, and the roll was across his leg and across the floor, and it was going like so, and our cat went right into his leg. And he screamed at me across the table at 1 o'clock in the morning, and we said, the heck with this? This is terrible. We're grown-ups. What are we doing this for? But the problem was in comics fandom at that point was people would announce big issues and collect the subscription money, and then they would fold the magazine and keep the money. So he said, okay, we're going to be an example. We're going to finish this through the end of the year. December will be the last issue. And then if we've got any extra subscription money that goes beyond that, we're going to return it to those subscribers. And then we'll do a countdown. So Alan Light, who was in high school, contacted us and said, look, you don't want to do the mailing, you don't want to do the subscription list, you don't want to handle all that, I'll publish it for you and take all that off your back and you can continue to do the magazine. And we said in that wonderful way we had, get off, kid. We said we're quitting. So he had the money that he'd saved from doing summer chores. And he said, I will start a magazine. And thus was Comics Buyer's Guide born under the name of The Buyer's Guide for Comic Fandom. The reason for that name was there were buyer's guides all over, but this was a specific one. And so that went on and on and on and on. And then, and Movie Collectors World, which we also wrote for Alan, because what happened was we discovered we liked doing something, just not much. And so it kept us in touch, and we did the columns, and we had done our contributions using our modern Selectric typewriter with the type balls. It was a Selectric 2. It was very expensive. We could have two pitches, so you could do Pica and Elite, and we did it on four legal-length pieces of paper taped like that, and then he would photograph it, and that was how it would run. And people like the Hernandez brothers, whom we'd never heard of because they were just starting, they did filler cartoons. So, yeah, so in my house, I have original Hernandez brothers art used as fillers with rubber cement. Well, okay. So then Alan, one day, sold both movie collectors. It was Film Collectors World. Sold that to Krause Publications. Chet Krause had started as a coin collector with advertising-supported coin publications called Numismatic News, and it was all basically classified ads for numismatics. Well, when the coin market tanked, as markets do, he diversified into sports cards and old cars and so forth, and he was always on the prowl for collector publications. And he paid Alan a bucket load of money and said to Alan, can you suggest anyone who could turn it into a newspaper? And Don had come off 23 years at the Cleveland Press, which just folded that summer, and it was October, and we got the job. We came, Chet picked us up at the airport and interviewed us the entire trip to Iola. And then there's celebrities here who are so important that you forget to turn off their phone. And so we were hired. We bought a house, sold a house. Our kids had chicken pox. We moved. We opened our Christmas presents and put them all back in the boxes. And Mayflower came on the 27th of December. And so we took over. Movie Collectors World didn't make it because our ad manager didn't want to bother actually working. But we had a very good ad manager for CBG. And we changed the names of both. We changed Film Collectors World to Movie Collectors World because by that time, if you think there's division in comics, oh my lord, movies. So it was the 8mm collectors, silent 8mm collectors, the sound 8mm collectors, the 16mm collectors, the guys who only wanted the posters, the guys who only wanted the insert cards. Oh, but you know, videotape is coming. We had a Beta machine. And we had friends who actually had like a U-matic. Talk about formats that didn't make it at all. Yeah. And so we said, let's just call it Movie Collectors World, and it doesn't matter. So the difference is comics fans read for pleasure. You don't know how rare that makes us. So the letters of comment to Movie Collectors World were kind of like movie, King Kong, you know, Willis O'Brien and misspelled Ray Harryhausen. And you couldn't just go online to check spelling, so that was very exciting. So the inarticulate nature of the Movie Collectors World Readers, and we were getting long exegesis on writing and the skills and the history and the whatever in comics, and it was great. So Krause sold Movie Collectors World to Brian Buchanan, who did Goldmine for Record Collectings with Eddie. So then we did CBG for 30 years, and the reason that we are happy that this was $16.99 is that the way our budgets were being cut, if we had done an issue 1700, it would have been all newsprint, half the size. The problem, people say the internet killed it. It wasn't just the internet. It was also basically the distributor. The distributors all went into one distributor. So it was Diamond. So we used to get ads from people trying to reach comic shops for Capital City distribution, and that was in Madison and so forth and so on. And all that you needed to do to promote your publication was to buy an ad in Previews. You didn't have to have an ad in CBG. So we lost the classified ads to the internet, and we lost the display ads to Previews. And we said at one point, so deep background, we actually sat in a meeting where they called us on the carpet because here's Wizard that just started, and all the kids are going for Wizard, and oh my gosh, and we know the little background about how, like, Wizard said that it would be able to tell you what the price was going to be in their next price guide for something that hadn't been published yet, so you really want to get Wizard. And so they said to us, well, you say you know everything, and you say, well, we didn't say we know everything, but we're experts, we're long-term experts. Here's this new publication that's got more subscribers than we've got. Luckily, our publisher had done research, and what we said was, Greg, to our publisher, tell them what the printing bill alone was on the issue of Wizard number one, which they gave away. And the printing bill alone was $55,000 for Wizard World. And we said, if you will give us the budget, we will be delighted to produce a publication that will be just as exciting. And they all said, oh, okay. So we ended up with newsprint and cheesier paper and so forth and so on. That's the end of the bookends, except that what happened was that Tomorrow's, bless their heart, did an issue of Alter Ego, and it was the issue we would have liked to have done for 1700. So in effect, that issue is issue 1700. And it went to contributors and asked them for comments and columns. I believe Mr. Evanier participated. Wake up.
No, I'm here.
I'm just saying. So now speak about your involvement with this wonderful publication. As noted, yes, he was in Alan Light's first issue?
Fourth issue.
Okay.
Fourth or fifth
issue. Alter Ego 122.
Thank you. Alter Ego 122.
Okay.
Thank you.
I still have Buyer's Guide number one from Alan, and I think I have the first and last issues. One of the problems with the paper, especially when it's a new paper, is there was just no way to store it. And if you did have a pile of them, there was no way to find anything in it. So I finally, you all know how hard it is to do this sometimes, threw them away. I had to have somebody else physically carry them out because I was not capable of putting anything in my collection into the trash can. My recollection is Peter David was doing a column that people liked, and people kept saying to me, why don't you do a column that people will like? And I said to Mandy one day, how about if I do a column that people will like? And she said, fine, so start doing it. And I did it for, I don't know how long. I did like, you know, what about...
Not long
three,
enough.
Three years of it.
It started in 1994.
Okay.
And you did it all the way till the end, which was...
No, I didn't do it all the way
to 2013.
No, he didn't do it all the way to the end.
I quit in a huff. Or a minute and a huff.
Yes. In a huff.
Yes.
I remember that.
It's a little vehicle, just a single driver and a passenger, yes.
Something about who owned the copy of it.
No.
Copyright.
No, it was over a penny a word. And I was giving all the money to the Comic Legal Defense Fund, so it wasn't even my money. But shortly after I won the annual poll of the most popular column, I found out that Peter David was getting a penny more than I was. So I thought, gee, if this is going to the Comic Legal Defense Fund, I ought to get And we're talking about, what those columns are like 1,500 words, so we're talking about, you know, 1,500 extra pennies. And I talked to someone, I don't know who it was, at Krause, and they said, oh no, we're not going to give you any more money, and we really wish you wouldn't write so much that wasn't about comic books. And I said, I'll write what I want for my own blog, thank you, goodbye. And that was at that point I had just started a blog. And
by the way, the best. Every day, check it like five times.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. No, don't check it five times. I'll feel guilty because I don't put enough up. I didn't even put anything up this morning. Anyway, because I'm at the convention, and I immediately quit, and that was the end of the column.
I wonder. So I wasn't privy. Understand? They kept me out of these discussions. Just so you know, deep background. And eventually, as I kept trying to interfere, and they finally said, look, you just don't want to be involved with this because we know you're friends with him and we don't want the friendship damaged. So my bet is that you are being paid one-time use and Peter David is being paid perpetual but non-exclusive.
I never got a scrap of paper to indicate rights being sold.
I love it. Yeah.
So I take the position that
you are absolutely entitled to whatever position you wish to take.
But I just thought.
Oh, absolutely. It's nuts.
If you want my actual tune, I think the person I talked to just didn't like the column and was glad to get rid of it.
And it probably didn't understand it. It would be. Here's among the facts that you need to know about life. There's people who read for pleasure. And people who don't read for pleasure, they will never understand each other and they will have contempt for each other. There are people who collect and people who do not collect. And they do not understand each other and they have contempt for each other. Sometimes a publisher or an ad manager of a collector publication will be one of those who do not collect and have contempt for those who do collect, which is not a good mix. The other Evanier anecdote I will mention is that at one point I went to the book department, which was separate from the magazine department, and I said, I think we could have a bestseller if we package his column, because it's behind the scenes in television, it's behind the scenes in animation, it's behind the scenes in comics, it's all sorts of perspective. People have never read about what it's like to be backstage as a fan at a show, that kind of thing. This could be our breakout bestseller. And the response I got from the book department was, we don't do bestsellers.
That's a self-fulfilling prophecy right there, isn't
Why,
it?
Why, yes it is. And I later found out that what they actually meant was that we basically, I don't know if you know, in grocery stores, like people pay to shelve their Cheerios in a particular aisle, and it's a shelving fee. And the shelving fee that Krause bought was for collector publications. And this would be a general market that we hadn't arranged shelving for. So I still think it could have been our breakout bestseller. And that was long before this breakup. Because, his was among the columns where I just couldn't wait till they came in to read them. Because it was just so much. And I learned things I never knew. R.C.,
oh,
you favored us.
I get to talk now. Good
yes.
D.
Yeah, see, that's the problem being on one of my panels.
I started subscribing to the Buyer's Guide in 1972 in May. And it had started in February the previous year. So I was probably one of the longest subscribers that there was. Beautiful Balloons, according to my notes, began in August of 1972. Did you have something in the paper before that?
I don't think so. I don't remember. What issue number was it? 19, I think, was...
August 1972.
Okay. I think it was issue... I don't know. I didn't do the research.
Anyway.
I'm on this panel. I didn't do the research.
Maggie said I'm up here because I am a columnist, or was, and that's really... that's not true. I tried to be a columnist. I would send stuff in, and it would never be printed. And then I started doing book reviews... And I had to get Brent Frankenhoff, or whatever his name
was. That's his name. Very good.
To approve the book I was going to review before I could write the review. So I got him to approve something, and that was fine. And the next week, Maggie reviewed that very same thing. So I was sort of miffed by that, see, and I thought, well, the buyer's guide for the comics buyer's guide really ought to be about comics. And I determined that the reason I was never in the paper, or seldom in the paper, I think I was in three times, something like that. And the reason was that Mark Evaner was writing, you know, page after page after page of stuff, which was about television and Hollywood, had nothing to do with comics. Absolutely nothing. And Peter David had page after page. He was writing about God knows what, but it wasn't comics, you see. And I thought, if we could only get back to comics, maybe we could save the whole thing. But that never happened. So I wrote Mark a letter. He may not remember this letter. We had never met. I just wrote him a letter. And the letter was a story about the Herald Tribune girl in France, where I spent some time years ago. And I had written this letter without, I don't think I even said, "Dear Mark," or anything like that. I just sent it to him. It was an article about the Herald Tribune girl, by which I was vaguely saying, the Herald Tribune girl is about as relevant to comics as most of your columns are, which are about television and actors and things like that. But of course, it was so vague that Mark couldn't possibly even see the hint, let alone do anything.
Well, I think I got it the week I published my Doug Wilde obituary.
What was that?
I think I got it the same week that my column was a Doug Wilde obituary. I thought, I'm writing about comics, just not every week.
Anyway, so I'm a buyer's guide columnist who never made it. I want to say hello to Randy Rinaldo. Wave back there, Randy.
Hey, Randy Rinaldo!
Special guest this year after coming to this thing for hundreds of years. He does one of the last adventure story comics that looks anything like Milton Caniff and all the rest of those people.
And he'll be here in about an hour and a half.
Yes.
Stick around.
Yes.
All right.
Scott, you didn't. You weren't exactly a columnist.
No, I wasn't a columnist. I'll tell you how I got into writing about comics was Randy Rinaldo, who sent me. He knew I'd just been a collector for years. We'd been coming with a group of friends of ours. We've been coming here since, I want to say, 1988, and 30 years ago. Good Lord.
And you are a whippersnapper, a young whippersnapper.
He sent me an email that he had received. He was on a mailing list for Wizard Magazine, and they were looking for an expert about a certain topic. And he said, "Hey, do you want to do this?" I got in. It was my first paid writing gig. I was like, "Oh, wow, look at me. I'm getting paid to be a writer." And I was working on an article about Nightwing, and I was interviewing Scott McDaniel. And I started telling him about the history of the character, which he didn't know. You know, I'm like, okay, this DC likes to say this is where the name came from, but then I bring in the whole Bottled City of Kandor, all that kind of stuff. And he was loving it. He says, "I never knew this. I'm working on the character. I had no idea." So I said, "Well, let's put it in the article." And what was the first thing that got cut? The history. And I loved my time writing for them, but I knew for them it was all about the here and now. And for me, it's always been about the history. And so I was mentioning this again to Randy here at Comic-Con. He said, "Well, if you want to talk about comics history, if you want to really get into it, you really need to be writing for CBG. And he walks me over and introduces me to Maggie and John Jackson Miller, who was here that year, and Brent Frankenhoff as well. And I was just kind of spitballing ideas. This was 1997. I believe it was 97. I think Gwen Stacy, her death was in 1972. Sorry, spoiler again.
So anniversary.
Yeah, it was the 25th anniversary. So that was my kind of perspective I had. Let's talk about history. Well, it's 25 years. And I remember I was doing a Shakespearean production at the time. I was on tour. And I'm in the artistic director's office, and I'm talking on my cell phone to John. And I'm like, "Oh, I got this great idea. It's 25 years, and I saw John Romita, and he doesn't know where the snap came from." And he said, actually, no, I hadn't mentioned the snap. John told me one of the best editorial lines I'd heard. He says, "It's not enough to say, hey, it's been 25 years. How about that? It's been 25 years. I mean, what else are we going to say? You have to have a hook." And that's when I remembered the previous year seeing John Romita on a panel and saying, "I honestly have no idea who put that snap in." And I thought, oh that's history. So so the article came out, and I remember when I pitched it to him, he still wasn't quite sure what I was talking about. And he said, all right, I tell you what. If we can't use it, we'll put it in our annual Spider-Man issue. If nothing else, we'll use it there. And I was thinking, okay. So I wrote it up and I sent it off. And I remember when I did, I emailed it that morning. And he calls me that afternoon. And he says, I got to be honest, I don't think I realized what we had. He says, we're going to make a big deal about this. And it was wonderful to see it come to fruition. I still have those the proofs, those mm-hmm. gorgeous bright white proof
yeah.
sheets,
yeah.
All four pages. I got the cover and then the three article pages up on my wall. And I have to say, to me, CBG is the gift that just keeps on giving. I stopped writing for comics, about comics about 20 years ago and started narrating audiobooks. And every once in a while, an issue comes up, a pronunciation issue. And I know that I can reach out. I remember I reached out to Mark. This was about 5 years ago. Larry Ty wrote a book about Superman.
Yeah.
And I reached out to Mark, and I said, I don't know if you remember me, but here's the thing. There's a lot of names, and I know who they are. I've met a lot of them, but I've never said their names out loud. Like Mort Weisinger. I remember saying, do you really pronounce the hard G? You know, in my job, we really got to know this. And so we spent about 20 minutes on the phone that day. And, you know, I'm running into you, Maggie, every time I come down here. I'm just... My years contributing to CBG were a gift, and you know, that just keeps
somebody
going.
Once asked me how to pronounce Kurt Busiek's name, and I
yeah.
did it phonetically, and they said, "You're joking." You know, it's like, no.
And, you know, what's funny is I did the same thing, and I had to call him and ask,
right.
and I'm like, "I've been saying it this way for years." Am I
yeah.
right? He said, "Yeah." And I forget to mention just a minute ago what I love about everything coming full circle. Last year, I got hired to do part of a short story collection about Predator. And one of the stories... No, it was Halo. Pardon me. It was a Halo collection. And one of the stories was by John Jackson Miller, who's gone on to a great writing career.
Star Trek, Star Wars,
right, exactly.
And Halo.
He's the franchise guy.
Yep.
I call him up. I'm like, dude, I'm reading your stuff. It's awesome.
It's by the way, for historical note, Krause Publications moved its facilities this year from Iola, Wisconsin, to Stevens Point, which is about 35 miles away. And they're renting a facility. Therefore, all the records, all the bound volumes, all the whatever that they weren't going to use, they have no place for it. So the numismatic material went, because Chet was a coin collector, that goes in the Iola historical thing. So I have been nagging them for years about the bound volumes of Buyer's Guide that were in the library. I said, what are you going to do with them? Oh, maybe the dumpster.
Oh,
yeah.
Jesus.
So we did a deal with Columbia University. So they put them on a pallet and shipped them to Columbia University. And then they said, I said, well, what about... So I was going in the library, and I said, well, what about these two entire movable shelving units of our research, the copies of Wizard, the distributor catalogs? They went, oh, well, those are going to go in the dumpster unless you can tell us what you want done, because we don't have any place to store them. So John Jackson Miller's garage.
Really?
Yes. Because he does Comic-Con. So if you go online, if you want statistics about comics, John Jackson Miller is the go-to guy. And on Comic-Con, he's got statistics on circulation back into the 40s. He loves to... He does standard deviation for fun. You know, that kind of thing. And so yeah, if you follow him on Twitter, he'll post on the Comic-Con stuff, but then you can go to Comic-Con and just see. So it's for Comic Chronicles, blah, blah. So
yeah.
Those went to his house. But then then the guy says to me, he says, well, so what about the 94 boxes of Buyer's Guides? I said, what are you talking about? And they're banker boxes, 94 banker boxes, this big. We're going to throw them out if you can't tell us what to do with them. And John put a deal together. He said, they shouldn't go in a dumpster. What happened was they were the forever copies. So every time an issue would come out, they'd take five mint copies, store them in the forever boxes. Well, forever's over. What are we going to do with these? And John put a deal together with Buddy Saunders, and Buddy Saunders took a truck and trucked them to Texas. So he had, because he's the one dealer who really specializes in fanzines as well as comic books. So they are preserved if people want to buy them. Obviously, he'd like money for them, but they didn't get thrown in the dumpster.
Yeah. Thank God.
And then the one thing I did was I went in and I said, what about these bound volumes? and he said, I don't know, you want them? And what they were the bound volumes of Movie Collectors World that Don and I had edited for 2 years, that they had bound, didn't send them to the guy who bought the publication. And so I took them home, and they are in my living room, and I can check them anytime.
I love that.
And my favorite, which is a non-comics anecdote, was that the favorite manuscript, aside from people here, that we ever did was for Movie Collectors World. And it was science fiction writer Lawrence Watt Evans did a column saying, you think Plan 9 from Outer Space is the worst movie ever made. It is not. The best worst movie ever made is Creature of Destruction. Do we know this movie?
No, I don't.
It's a Larry Buchanan remake of The She Creature, I believe. And it starred Aaron Kincaid. And Lawrence Watt Evans said, with the bland Aaron Kincaid gave a mediocre performance, blah, blah, blah. We got an over-the-transom manuscript from Aaron Kincaid saying it was not a bland performance. It was a blind performance, as in blind drunk, because I had to be drunk for the entire filming of this movie. And he said it was so miserable filming that his contract had said he had a film for 2 weeks, and he had finished the 2 weeks, and the filming wasn't done. And he said, I am going to the airport, and I'm getting out of here. And Larry Buchanan said, no, you, we haven't finished your scenes. He said, guess what? I'm out of here. So audio tape in the cab on the way to the airport, he read the rest of his lines. And those parts are performed by Larry Buchanan wearing his costume, filmed from the back. Later, he went on to play Killer Croc in Batman Adventures. So my heart belongs to Batman Adventures yet again.
I have a footnote.
Yes.
To Scott, you were talking about Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. I suppose everybody knows that Steve Ditko died last month.
Yes, yes.
And they found his body on the 29th of June. They assumed he had been dead for a couple of days. That's going out in obscurity, really.
Yeah.
Which is what he probably preferred.
Okay, I'm not on the 11 people panel on Ditko, which is going to be great. But I have to do my Ditko anecdote, because he was very sweet to us. And the brilliance of Spider-Man to me was Steve's characters tended to be quite stiff. You can't hear? Sorry. I usually project. His characters generally tended to be very stiff to our way of thinking. But the genius was in Spider-Man, that character is nothing but curves and fluidity. Yeah. And we said, not only that, but if you look at the Vulture or you look at Doc Ock, it's all rounded. It's in contrast to all the other characters. And how brilliant was that of him? And so we wrote a letter basically saying that to Stan Lee. And as a thank you, Steve sent us an 8.5 by 11 just piece of art of Spider-Man swinging forward, the Vulture, Doc Ock, and then the half-face Peter Parker Spider-Man image, just as a presentation art. And we're going, what are we supposed to do with this? We're doing a mimeograph publication. This is beautiful. He doesn't want us to print it in a mimeograph thing, so this is just an outright gift. So it's framing. I've got it on my. I've had people handle it and just like a handshake because it is such a beautiful piece. But it was just out of the blue. It's like, thank you for writing a nice letter about me to Stan Lee. And then when Doctor Strange began, without asking at all, he just did a presentation piece of Doc Strange. And this is just to fans. This is the kind of guy he was, just to fans. So, yes, Steve was incredible, incredible person. Now we got about 10 minutes. Dave Siegel has a question. I'll see you, Dave, first.
And this is something that Mark Evanier did for me. Back in, the year was 1995. And 2 years prior, I was working on the Going Age panels at San Diego Con. And I was not getting attendance very well. And so I went to Mark. And I asked him, would it be possible for me kind enough to write about this Golden Age panel that I was trying to put together? And I know that Joe Sennett was coming out in 1995. I was involved getting Ramon and Freyden out to Comic-Con that year. And so Mark was kind enough to do this wonderful background of every
For those who couldn't hear,
and it was just we had a great turnout because of that.
For those who couldn't hear, Dave was mentioning that thanks to promotion by Mark Evanier, suddenly there was increased attention on some of the people that Dave had managed to see were attending the convention, and suddenly people were starting to pay attention to the older creators as well as the current creators. And yes, that's exactly the kind of thing Mark has. You kind of do that as routine, don't you?
Yeah, I wish I had a friend like me.
I'll tell you one thing. It was really kind you to do that, Mark, for me. And then I had Ron Goulart hosting that panel. And what was even more nice afterwards, I was working with a gentleman named Chris Sternhan, who was the program director. And he was stepping down as program director. And I have no association with Comic-Con. What I used to do for Comic-Con, I worked outside the system. I never joined Comic-Con because I was just too specialized tracking down people, and I couldn't deal with committees. And I went to Mark Evanier. I need a front man. And Mark handled the Going Age panels out ever since then. He saved the panels.
Yep. And so, again, tributes to Mark for saving the Golden Age panels that they
needed. And you can see how well it went, because now those people all died on this. They can't do that.
Of course. And I had a question.
Ingratitude.
And I had a question over here next.
Hi.
That's Bob Miller, by the way.
Yes. And he did work for us, too, by the way. Another column.
Yes, for which I'm grateful. You gave me a star as a writer, so thank you for that. So anyway, I understand Michigan State University has a complete set of comics buyer's guide. Do you think there might be a possibility they could digitize it for all posterity?
Okay, the question here is about digitizing the entirety of Comics Buyer's Guide. Michigan State University probably does have the best collection. There are all kinds of legal questions about it. My bet is that they could go ahead and do it quietly, but not make it available outside its own facility. There's a huge copyright question in comics, as I'm sure you've dealt with too. And how do you do your research in terms of finding things online that are public domain, or that even if it's public domain, but if people don't care about it?
Well, I always assume that the copyright law, there's a clause of it that has to do with
Fair use.
Printing copyrighted material without permission. Fair use, is that the name of it?
Yes.
Yeah, fair use. And I bent that about as far as it can go. I did a book a couple years ago called Insider Histories of Cartooning. It was published by Mississippi Press. And they wanted me to go and get permissions from all the art that I was using to illustrate the essays that were in there. And I said, I don't need to do that. The fair use clause permits me to do this. As long as I'm not printing a whole comic book and selling it, you know, it's okay. And they said, no, you got to go do this. So about that time, the University of California had come out with another book on the history of comics, printing a lot of stuff, and they used the fair use clause. And so I told the Mississippi people, well, University of California, they can do it. Why can't you do it? And all of a sudden, they could do it. So
we always operated. CBG was always fair use.
Yes.
And we always tried to run the original copyright, because the whole thing about copyright is you just say you don't own it. This person owns it. And you'll note that there's a copyright statement on every. So I do a column for Comic-Con, and there's copyright notices with all. And we've been asked to wrap up, so there was one last question from you. Yes.
And the thing about the copyright, just a minute, the thing about the copyright thing is it was the fair use thing was designed, the intention of the fair use thing was to permit exactly the kinds of use of art in publications and books that I did and a lot of other people did. And if it's not being used, if you're going and getting permission for stuff that you really are covered with fair use,
right,
the fair use law is going to just simply fade out of existence.
Right.
So you got to use it.
Yeah. Quick question to wrap up?
I'll make it quick. Yes. One thing I remember about the CBG, besides the articles and everything, was they used to get really thick. They'd have a big staple that was holding it together. And I had to buy needle nose pliers to try to take it apart, because I'd always cut my finger and bleed all over.
Oh, man.
I'm glad that there's nice copies. But the coolest thing that ever happened is kind of weird, but when Julie Schwartz passed away, I wrote a letter in talking about what a great guy he was and how friendly he was to me. And on the letters page, my letter was published.
good company.
I think it went better than that. So I just want to say thank
I you. Want you to imagine me sitting at the editor's desk and getting all those letters. And putting them together so that they work. So thank you,
can
folks.
Can I say something real quick?
Yeah.
I think I speak for everybody here. Anybody who can assemble as much talent and so many contributors and do so much to preserve the history of comics, that's a mitzvah that you've, Maggie, that you've done for the industry.
Yes.
CBG was a gift.
Spread the word, guys. Comics are cool. And now, Randy Rinaldo is... Are you next?
No.
Oh. Yeah, come back in an hour. So focus on Randy Rinaldo.
All right. Thank you, folks, for coming. Much appreciated. Thanks for fighting the escalator.